We get lots of stories all together that kind of point to one sort of idea. So we'll hook in and see how God moves through the story of Jacob. Now, so far in the book of Genesis, we have seen God create a perfect and ordered world for us to live in and enjoy relationships with each other and with God. However, humanity decided that they wanted to make the rules and determine what was good and evil for themselves. They disobeyed God and brought chaos into that order. They brought jealousy, violence, fear, and pride. We watched as humanity spiraled out of control, going downwards, enslaved by their own vices, getting worse and worse. But God was with them through it. He was kind, he cared for them, and he promised a way that everything would be fixed one day through a human. God then called Abraham out away from his land, his gods, his family, and his people to a new land to become a new version of humanity. We watched as there was a growing relationship between Abraham and God as he learned to trust who he was. Abraham made many mistakes, but God proved to be faithful time and time again. Then we saw God was also with Abraham's son Isaac, and he blessed him. We are now looking at Abraham's grandson, Jacob. We saw last week that Jacob was blessed by God to be the one through whom God would continue to fulfill his promises. He was the one who God decided to bless. We saw that God decides who he blesses. We saw that the biggest blessing is a relationship with God, and all the other blessings are an outworking of that relationship. We also saw that God's blessing is always a matter of God's grace, as Jacob did not seem like a very deserving sort of a chap. Now this week, Jacob is on the run. He has just tricked his older brother out of his birthright and tricked Isaac to bless him instead of his brother Esau, and Esau wants to kill him. Jacob is running to the land where Abraham came from, and is headed to his mother's family, so that while he is away fleeing for his life, he can also find for himself a wife. He's there to look for a bride from his mum's family. Now, at this stage in Jacob's life, there's nothing really that indicates that he knows God at all or has any real care about God at all. We know that his mother and father pray for him, and we know that they know God, so he might have some idea, but there's not really a proper relationship yet. So as he's fleeing, he lays down and goes to sleep, and he has a dream. In that dream, he sees a stairway to heaven, and there are God's messengers going up and down. And God is on top, and he says to Jacob, "I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All the peoples on the earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go. And I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised." So this reiterates a lot of the promises that Abraham had given to him by God. And now we know they're going to happen through Jacob. And on top of it, God promises that he will bring him back home out of exile as he is fleeing from his brother. And God will be with him. So Jacob has this dream and he wakes up scared. He's shaken by what he has seen. I suspect that he's also feeling pretty guilty about the chaos that he has left and the way he has deceived everyone and the problems that he has caused. And now he's been brought before the God who he has sidelined and ignored. He thinks, "Surely God is in this place and I was not aware of it." He places a stone and he calls the place Bethel, which means house of God. Then he makes a vow. Now, the thing about Jacob, though, is that he's always angling for the deal. He doesn't just accept God and continue the way he goes, but he says to God, if God watches over him, provides for him everything that he needs, lets him return to his father's house, then God will be his God, and he will give him 10% of what God gives him. And then we have this big set of stories which are a mess of human conflicts and battling pride, and they all point to a God who is providing for Jacob in the face of these extreme difficulties. They also have a lot of similarities to other stories that we have about Abraham and his family. We'll fly through them, and I recommend that when you get home, you give them a full read. But through them, we get this picture of God's constant faithfulness to his people and his promises despite our human pride and our messiness. So Jacob wants to see if God will look after him while he is in exile, and he goes looking for his mother's family. He comes across a well, and there is a big rock over the top of the well, and there are shepherds waiting there. They're waiting till there are enough shepherds so that they can move the rock, and then they can all drink, and then move the rock back. So Jacob asks these shepherds if they know Laban, who is his mother's brother, so his uncle. The shepherds say, oh yeah, we know him, he's around. And straight away, Laban's daughter Rachel comes to water her sheep. They're all still waiting for enough shepherds to move the stone. So Jacob, who is up for impressing a pretty lady, comes and he rolls the stone away by himself to give water to her sheep. Then he gets really excited that she's related, and they kiss, and she takes him back to her father. And he's excited that he has a place among his relatives that he can stay. He works as he stays there for a while. And after a bit, Laban, his uncle, says, well, you should get paid for your work. You shouldn't just work for being my relative. What is it that you want? And Rachel has caught his eye. And as it seems in Genesis, if you see a woman by a well, that woman is probably worth marrying. So Jacob says that he will work for 7 years to have Rachel's hand in marriage. Laban agrees. However, Rachel has an older sister called Leah, who does not catch Jacob's attention. And after 7 years, Jacob wants his wife. So Laban throws a feast. There is presumably lots of drinking. And when the time comes, Laban sends Leah to Jacob instead, and he consummates the marriage. In the morning, Jacob sees that he's been tricked by a mistaken identity, which is not really unlike the sort of trickery we've seen Jacob himself be a part of. And he confronts Laban, and Laban says that he has to marry his older daughter off first before the younger one. That's just what you do. So he says, if you wait for a week for Leah's bridal week to be over, then you can marry Rachel, but you still have to work for another 7 years of service. So he marries Rachel and has to work for another 7 years. In this, Jacob clearly has a favourite wife, and Leah is not so loved. But in that, God cares for the downtrodden and the outcast. So he enables Leah to conceive and have a child. And then she says, surely my husband will love me now. And then over the next 7 years of Jacob's life, we see a kind of battle between his two wives where they all want to provide as many children as they can for him. And when they can't provide children for him, they give him their servants to have children with, not unlike the story with Abraham, Sarah, and Hagar. But this is kind of on steroids. And at the end of 7 years, he ends up with 11 sons and one daughter. And Rachel, she only gives him one biological child, a boy named Joseph. This is messy and it is ridiculous. Yet despite all the messy jealousy, pride and bargaining that goes on, God blesses Jacob with a large family of descendants. Then after 7 years, Jacob has paid his debt and he wants to leave. But tricksy old Uncle Laban has seen a fortune teller recently And he finds out that the reason that he has prospered over the last 14 years is because God has been blessing him because of Jacob. So he wants him to stay. Then Jacob agrees to stay if he can keep all of the animals that have spots or speckles and all of the dark lambs. So tricksy Uncle Laban agrees, but he goes through all his flocks that day and takes away all of the animals that would qualify to be Jacob's. And he gives them to his sons, and he gets his sons to take them for a 3 days' ride away, so Jacob gets nothing. Jacob then has an interesting foray into animal husbandry and has worked out that if he put striped branches in front of the animals during breeding, they would produce striped and spotted offspring. Now, that doesn't actually work, but there was a customary thought that people believed that they had such a vivid sense of sight during the breeding process that the animals would produce offspring of a similar colour that they were looking at while they were pregnant. There's no scientific validation, but it seems that God was watching Jacob and caused the animals to be speckled and striped anyway. He also used it to make sure that his flock was bred strong, and then he just gave the weaker ones to tricksy old Uncle Laban. So despite Laban's tricks again, God provides abundantly for Jacob and prospers him. He ends up with a very large flock and a large number of servants, camels and donkeys. Then Laban starts to get annoyed with Jacob and jealous of his success over his own. So God warns Jacob to take his wealth and run, and God will be with him. So he takes his family and what is now a rather considerable number of livestock and servants, and he flees without telling Laban. And as a side note, Rachel, before she leaves, she steals the household gods and takes them with them without telling Jacob. After 3 days, Laban realizes that they're all gone and he chases after them. It takes him and his men 7 days to catch up with them. But just before they get there, the night before, he has a dream and God warns Laban not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. Now, I wonder why God tells him not to say anything good to Jacob. I can understand the bad, but the good seems a bit difficult. Now, I think the reason is that Laban has proven himself to be a liar. And one of the things about liars is that when they're caught lying, they tend to just lie some more. I also suspect that Jacob has put up with a real lot at this stage at his hands. And if he were to start saying kind things or spinning lies, that would probably only succeed in enraging him and making things worse. So Laban catches up with Jacob and confronts him, acting like Laban is the innocent one that has been hard done by for his actions. He asks why Jacob stole the gods, why he wouldn't let him kiss his grandchildren goodbye. Jacob doesn't know anything about the gods, so he says, "That's fine, search my camp, you'll find nothing." And Rachel, she cleverly hides them so that the search brings up nothing. Then Jacob has his turn and he lets loose on Laban, taking him to task for the deception and exploitation that he has dealt with over the last 20 years now. Despite Jacob's faithfulness and effective service, Laban has been cruel. In this little rant, he says that if it wasn't for God, then he would be leaving Laban empty-handed. Now, this is interesting news for us because it seems that Jacob's condition for making God his God is being met, but in abundance. And more excitingly, Jacob knows it. He is learning the faithfulness of God just as his grandfather Abraham did and his father Isaac did. So Laban relents, probably somewhat reluctantly. God has made sure that he has no grounds to stand on to fight. So they make a covenant with each other, which is probably just like a treaty saying that they're not going to attack each other and everything will be fine. Now, if we think about this situation, it is a mess of different motivations and different sins against each other. If you read Laban's complaints against Jacob, he says, Jacob left him without letting him kiss his grandchildren goodbye, which is quite a reasonable complaint to make. And on top of that, there's the fact that Rachel stole the family gods off him. If you were to try and judge the percentage of which one was right in the situation, we certainly wouldn't have Jacob and his family at 100% right. It's a mess of emotions and motivations. But in the end, through God, a peace is struck. Jacob and his family start to take off, but now standing between them and home is Jacob's brother Esau, the one who's the reason that he left in the first place. But while they travel, some angels meet with Jacob, just a reminder that God is with him. Jacob then sends some messengers forward to his brother Esau to deliver a friendly message and butter him up a little bit. The messengers return and they tell him that Esau is coming to meet him with 400 men. Jacob is terrified and he spends a lot of time preparing to try and appease his brother's anger. He splits up his camp in two so that if one side is attacked, the other side might have a chance at escaping. He also prepares a bunch of gifts of livestock, lots of them, and sends them forward ahead of him so that they're what greets Esau. Jacob then sends everyone ahead of him and he spends the night alone. That night, he wrestled with a man all night long. Then the man realizes that he can't overpower Jacob and he pops out Jacob's hip. The man says, "Let me go because it is daybreak." But Jacob demands to be blessed before the man leaves. And the man says that Jacob will no longer be named Jacob, but Israel, because he has struggled with God and with humans and has overcome. Jacob asks the man's name and the man replies, "Why do you ask my name?" And instead he just blesses Jacob. Jacob then calls the place Face of God, because he said that he saw the face of God and yet his life was spared. Now this is a mysterious story, and in a lot of ways it sort of sums up Jacob's relationship with God and humanity's relationship with God, as we've seen in the story. God is usually working for the good of the humans, and yet it is a constant struggle. There is a mix of dependence and a need for blessing, and then defiance and a demand for self-reliance and independence. This night, Jacob is at his lowest, his most fearful. It is also the moment that is at the heart of his deal with God. Either God will get him home safely, or Jacob won't call him his God. Jacob wrestles with him all night and refuses to back down. Now, it probably wasn't actually God wrestling with him. In the book of Hosea, it says that Jacob wrestled with an angel. So it's probably an angel representing God who he's fighting. But whatever the details are, as we've been looking at the life of this scheming trickster, a wrestle with God perfectly sums up the way he has lived. For Abraham and Isaac, their issue with God has been more about their level of trust in him rather than a reluctance to serve him. But Jacob fights him at every turn, and even though God is powerful enough to pop out his hip when he wants to, he stays with him in the struggle. Jacob even points to the impossibility of his fight, and he calls the place the Face of God because he acknowledges that he wrestled with God and yet God spared his life. So the next morning, it is the day of reckoning for Jacob. And he goes to confront his own deceptive ways and his hard-done-by brother with his army of 400 men. So Jacob goes forward to meet him. He orders his family to go behind him, and he orders them in the order that he likes the most, so the servants and their children first, then Leah and her children, and Rachel and Joseph at the back. Just in case he strikes, then his favourite ones will be safer. Jacob comes forward and bows before his brother. But his brother races up to him, throws his arms around him in a big hug and kisses him. He's excited to see him. Then he sees his family standing beside him, and he's like, who are these? And he's excited to meet his nephews and his niece. And he asks, what were all those gifts about that you sent forward? And Jacob says that they were to find favor in Esau's eyes because God has been gracious to him. Esau says that he has enough and doesn't need it, but after a while, he eventually reluctantly accepts all the livestock and stuff. Esau then invites him back to his house in Seir and offers men to help them on their way. But Jacob says that he will meet him there, and he refuses any help on his part. So God has ensured that this meeting goes well, really well. There is a redemption for Jacob in his brother's eyes. The relationship has been restored. But then Jacob, being Jacob, doesn't follow him back to his house in Seir, but goes in a different direction. Just another hint at deception on his part. Well, this has been a rather large chunk of the story, but it's probably one great big story arc for Jacob. He's gone from not knowing or trusting in God or getting an experience of God to making a deal with God and relying on it. He then reaps these massive benefits from the deal, and yet he continues to wrestle with God figuratively and literally. We've also seen something in the way that God works through this story. He is constantly faithful and working for the good of the humans, and yet all the people are constantly making things messy and difficult and causing conflict and strife with each other. Jacob gets a taste of his own scheming ways with his tricksy uncle Laban, and yet he continues to deceive his brother Esau with half-truths. There's something very real about the messiness of it all. When I think about how things should go, I often have an idea of if I do A, then B should happen, followed by C, and the goal of D will be in my sight. And in my head, the condition for those things working is that if I just do what I'm supposed to, that will all just work. In reality, however, once my plan involves other people, then A to B to C to D, that simplicity goes out the window because someone thinks that E should actually be our important goal. And the way to get there is actually G, F to E. And then someone else, they can't do B because they're allergic. And then I found out that D and C aren't talking to each other. And then the person who is supposed to get A done is only just saying that they're only just saying that D is their goal when actually their goal is to get to Q. And then there's a long weekend and everybody's away. And by the time we get to doing D, I'm a little bit worn out and I become the problem myself. Things often don't go according to the plans in our minds. We often have a web of people all striving for their different goals and all dealing with their own challenges. We can often have an idea in our minds of how we want our lives to play out, but that doesn't often account for the messiness of humanity. People deceive you. People fight for their own goals. People deceive themselves. People fight for their pride. People don't see things the way that seems obvious to you. And to top it off, you do all of those things too. When life's messiness happens, we often point to it as a sign that God is not where we want him to be, that we are hard done by. But in this story, we see God working and moving through the messiness of humans. God planned to bless Jacob and turn his family into a nation. And through proud and selfish people, he works things to give him the start of that with 12 children. Through the messiness, God is working his plan for good and blessing. As much as I don't want to admit it, I am a lot like Jacob. I flit between dependence on God and my drive for my own independence. I've been Christian long enough to know the right answers, and yet, often my actions don't reflect that. I spend some nights wrestling with God. I would like to think that he often wins, but perhaps more often than not, he has to pop out my hip because I'm too stubborn to admit that his way is the right way. God hasn't changed. In the midst of our mess, of people's tangled selfish pride, God sent Jesus to provide for us a way out. He blessed us when we just messed things up. Jesus took on the punishment for all the chaos that we cause so that we can one day live in his ordered kingdom. Now God has not taken his eye off the ball, and he has seen us in the mess that we create for ourselves through our lack of trust, our greed, our pride. And just as with Jesus, he still comes down and meets us there and provides for us. Things rarely turn out the way that we intend them, but God is there amidst the chaos of our imperfection and our rebellion, and his plans work throughout it. So perhaps this week, when the wrestle starts with you, maybe you could let God win. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you that you work through our imperfections. Your ways are not foiled by our weakness. Thank you that you lead and guide, and you even love us despite our desire to wrestle. I pray, Lord, as we go throughout our week, we can trust you more. We know your heart, your care. We know your ways are better than ours. I pray, Lord, that we can show others who you are too. Show them that their wrestle doesn't need to be so strong. I pray, Lord, as we go throughout our week, we'll show you and we'll love you. In Jesus' name, amen.